University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June Examination Session 2005. English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your center number, candidate number, and your name on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. Now you're all ready, here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Why is Nikos late meeting his friends?
Nikos, at last! Where have you been? We've been waiting ages for you.
What do you mean? I'm on time. Look, it's only 10:15.
No, it's not. Your watch has stopped. It's nearly 11 o'clock. Nikos, at last! Where have you been? We've been waiting ages for you.
What do you mean? I'm on time. Look, it's only 10:15.
No, it's not. Your watch has stopped. It's nearly 11 o'clock.
Question 2. Mariam wants to open a student bank account. Apart from her passport, which 2 things must she take with her to do this?
Hello, is that the bank?
Yes, madam. How may we help you?
My name is Mariam Al-Noor, and I would like to open a student account.
Good morning, Ms. Al-Noor. You'll need to come in and see us in person to do that. Please don't forget to bring your passport, birth certificate, and a document which has your address on it to prove where you live.
Okay. I'll come in tomorrow at 9:30. Hello, is that the bank?
Yes, madam. How may we help you?
My name is Mariam Al-Noor, and I would like to open a student account.
Good morning, Ms. Al-Noor. You'll need to come in and see us in person to do that. Please don't forget to bring your passport, birth certificate, and a document which has your address on it to prove where you live.
Okay. I'll come in tomorrow at 9:30.
Question 3. Bi Ling doesn't know where to go for a music lesson at her new college. Where exactly is the classroom located? Give 2 details.
Please, could you help me? I'm late for my class. Where's the music room, please?
Oh, it's in a different building. Go out of that door there, and you'll be on the field. Turn right, walk for a bit, and then look for the tallest building in the row opposite you. That's the music block. And the room you need is on the 2nd floor. Enjoy your class.
Thanks very much. Please, could you help me? I'm late for my class. Where's the music room, please?
Oh, it's in a different building. Go out of that door there, and you'll be on the field. Turn right, walk for a bit, and then look for the tallest building in the row opposite you. That's the music block. And the room you need is on the 2nd floor. Enjoy your class.
Thanks very much.
Question 4. Question 4. Where must Jean-Luc's group meet their teacher after free time?
Now listen, everyone. And yes, that includes you, Jean-Luc. You have free time now for half an hour. You must be in pairs or small groups. We're at the main station now. Look, it's here on the map. But I need you to meet me at the post office in 30 minutes. Now listen, everyone. And yes, that includes you, Jean-Luc. You have free time now for half an hour. You must be in pairs or small groups. We're at the main station now. Look, it's here on the map. But I need you to meet me at the post office in 30 minutes.
Question 5. Why is the ferry delayed? And how much will you pay for a drink while you wait?
We're sorry to announce the late arrival of the 6:35 ferry. This is because of adverse weather conditions. A complimentary hot drink may be obtained in the waiting room. We're sorry to announce the late arrival of the 6:35 ferry. This is because of adverse weather conditions. A complimentary hot drink may be obtained in the waiting room.
Question 6. Why can't Gregory purchase anything hot to eat in the cafe?
I would like some fish and rice, please, followed by apple pie and custard.
I'm sorry. We can only offer you cold food. Sandwiches, crisps and fruit at the moment.
Oh, that's annoying. Am I too late? I thought you served hot food until 1:30.
Well, blame it on a power cut we had this morning. The electricity has only just come back on.
I would like some fish and rice, please, followed by apple pie and custard.
I'm sorry. We can only offer you cold food. Sandwiches, crisps and fruit at the moment.
Oh, that's annoying. Am I too late? I thought you served hot food until 1:30.
Well, blame it on a power cut we had this morning. The electricity has only just come back on.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment you will hear part two. Now look at the questions for part two, exercise one. Part two. Part two, exercise one. Question 7. Listen to the following interview about a sponsored walk, and then fill in the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening. I'm Ken Malone. Welcome to Your Voice Counts, our weekly look at how what you do helps make life better for other people. Tonight, we have the story of two sisters, one of whom, Françoise Joannou, is here to talk to us. Ms. Joannou.
Oh, please, call me Françoise.
Françoise, you and your sister have just returned from an exhausting experience.
Yes, we have spent a month walking the Great Wall of China. It was all to raise money for a charity which supports research into diseases. We hope our little contribution goes towards saving some lives.
Tell us more about your trip. Why did you decide to carry out this expedition?
My sister became very ill. Thankfully, she recovered, and we were all so grateful for her restored health that we decided to do something to raise money to help medical research.
Why did you choose to go to the Great Wall of China?
Actually, it was already arranged. A large fundraising event was to take place there. It was called Walk for Life. And all we had to do was start collecting sponsors.
What do you mean by sponsors?
We asked people and businesses, local shops, schools, libraries and churches, everyone who knew us, in fact, to promise us a little money for each kilometre we walked.
I understand. How far did you walk then?
Well, the Great Wall is 5,000 kilometres long. It's endless. You can see it going on ahead of you over huge mountain ranges. Did you know it can be seen from space? We thought we'd try 100 kilometres, which sounded easy.
Yeah, that sounds a reasonable goal.
Remember that the Great Wall was built over 2,000 years ago as a protection against hostile tribes. It's as strong as a fortress. And because of that, it's often necessary to climb straight up for 1,500 metres. In one place, we had to clamber up 2,000 huge steps. At one point, we had to be pulled across a section above a reservoir on a harness. Quite terrifying.
Who walked with you?
There were guides and 56 other fundraisers who were taking part in the Walk for Life. We met so many local people en route. Some were washing clothes in streams or carrying water. Everyone stopped us and asked us where we were going and why. They were always so kind and hospitable. Everyone was so interested in our aims. And among the group members, too, there was great cooperation and a really friendly atmosphere.
Where did you rest?
In local hotels. We ate lots, too. We were extremely hungry after each day's climb. There was so much to see and do. We managed to visit places like the Black Dragon Pool Park and the first waterfall of Beijing, as well as Xi'an, home of the Terracotta Warriors.
And did you achieve your aim of 100 kilometres?
Yes, we did. And it's wonderful to know that the money raised will now be put towards research, which will help others to live longer.
Well done. Would you encourage our listeners to take part in another Walk for Life?
Oh, certainly. There are treks planned all over the world. Have a look at this website, www.walkforlife.net.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening. I'm Ken Malone. Welcome to Your Voice Counts, our weekly look at how what you do helps make life better for other people. Tonight, we have the story of two sisters, one of whom, Françoise Joannou, is here to talk to us. Ms. Joannou.
Oh, please. Call me Françoise.
Françoise, you and your sister have just returned from an exhausting experience.
Yes, we have spent a month walking the Great Wall of China. It was all to raise money for a charity which supports research into diseases. We hope our little contribution goes towards saving some lives.
Tell us more about your trip. Why did you decide to carry out this expedition?
My sister became very ill. Thankfully, she recovered. And we were all so grateful for her restored health that we decided to do something to raise money to help medical research.
Why did you choose to go to the Great Wall of China?
Actually, it was already arranged. A large fundraising event was to take place there. It was called Walk for Life, and all we had to do was start collecting sponsors.
What do you mean by sponsors?
We asked people and businesses, local shops, schools, libraries and churches, everyone who knew us, in fact, to promise us a little money for each kilometre we walked.
I understand. How far did you walk then?
Well, the Great Wall is 5,000 kilometres long. It's endless. You can see it going on ahead of you over huge mountain ranges. Did you know it can be seen from space? We thought we'd try 100 kilometres, which sounded easy.
Yeah, that sounds a reasonable goal.
Remember that the Great Wall was built over 2,000 years ago as a protection against hostile tribes. It's as strong as a fortress, and because of that, it's often necessary to climb straight up for 1,500 metres. In one place, we had to clamber up 2,000 huge steps. At one point, we had to be pulled across a section above a reservoir on a harness. Quite terrifying.
Who walked with you?
There were guides and 56 other fundraisers who were taking part in the Walk for Life. We met so many local people en route. Some were washing clothes in streams or carrying water. Everyone stopped us and asked us where we were going and why. They were always so kind and hospitable. Everyone was so interested in our aims. And among the group members, too, there was great cooperation and a really friendly atmosphere.
Where did you rest?
In local hotels. We ate lots, too. We were extremely hungry after each day's climb. There was so much to see and do. We managed to visit places like the Black Dragon Pool Park and the first waterfall of Beijing, as well as Xi'an, home of the Terracotta Warriors.
And did you achieve your aim of 100 kilometres?
Yes, we did. And it's wonderful to know that the money raised will now be put towards research, which will help others to live longer.
Well done. Would you encourage our listeners to take part in another Walk for Life?
Oh, certainly. There are treks planned all over the world. Have a look at this website, www.walkforlife.net.
That is the end of Part 2, Exercise 1. In a moment you will hear Part 2, Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 2, Exercise 2. Question 8. Listen to the following interview with the winner of a telephone text messaging poetry competition, and then fill in the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Welcome to Writer's World. Text messaging is becoming increasingly popular all around the world. Today, we focus on the annual text message poetry competition, which was started last year by some people in London, England. Tim Karambi won last year's competition and is here in the studio to talk to us. It's nice to meet you, Tim, and thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
To help anyone out there who doesn't know, perhaps you could tell us briefly what text messaging actually is.
Sure. It means sending a message anywhere in the world from a mobile phone. Sometimes it's referred to as texting. We use a special sort of shortened language for this, lots of abbreviations and so on. It's a bit like an email in some ways, but it has loads of advantages over that.
What is the advantage of text messages, in your opinion, then?
Speed. You can communicate instantly with someone, and it needn't make any sound or disturbance. It's an easy way of keeping in touch, perhaps even with people you normally wouldn't have telephoned or written to because of shortage of time or of cash. It's very quick to do and doesn't cost much.
So how did you hear about the competition?
Completely by chance. I just happened to read about it in a newspaper I found left on the train. Competition entries were invited from people to send poems by text message. The poems could use no more than 160 characters.
Characters?
Letters or words or punctuation marks.
160? That's not much for a proper poem, is it?
Well, why not? Some of the best poems can say a lot in very little space. And that is the whole art of text messaging, isn't it? And texting means you can be really brief. For example, instead of writing Y-O-U for the word you, we put just the letter U.
I'm not sure what my old English teacher would have to say about that. So, Tim, did many people enter?
About 7,500, actually. Most of them were from people like me, who'd never tried to write a text poem before. They composed their poems on the train, in traffic jams, on boats, on buses, anywhere, in fact. A short list of favourite entries was drawn up, and these poems were texted to each entrant. We all awarded each poem marks out of 10, so the final judges were the text poets themselves.
It sounds great fun. And the second competition is just being started, isn't it?
Yes, and there are really good cash prizes for winners. Plus, the chance to see your entry displayed on posters on 7,000 London buses and in the underground stations.
So, how do we enter?
Just text your poem to 880-1111. Oh, and you can find more information about the competition and can read last year's winning entries for inspiration on the internet at www.textpoetry.com. It's great fun, and you've got nothing to lose. Good luck.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Welcome to Writer's World. Text messaging is becoming increasingly popular all around the world. Today, we focus on the annual Text Message Poetry Competition, which was started last year by some people in London, England. Tim Karambi won last year's competition and is here in the studio to talk to us. It's nice to meet you, Tim, and thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
To help anyone out there who doesn't know, perhaps you could tell us briefly what text messaging actually is.
Sure. It means sending a message anywhere in the world from a mobile phone. Sometimes it's referred to as texting. We use a special sort of shortened language for this, lots of abbreviations and so on. It's a bit like an email in some ways, but it has loads of advantages over that.
What is the advantage of text messages, in your opinion, then?
Speed. You can communicate instantly with someone, and it needn't make any sound or disturbance. It's an easy way of keeping in touch, perhaps even with people you normally wouldn't have telephoned or written to because of shortage of time or of cash. It's very quick to do and doesn't cost much.
So, how did you hear about the competition?
Completely by chance. I just happened to read about it in a newspaper I found left on the train. Competition entries were invited from people to send poems by text message. The poems could use no more than 160 characters.
Characters?
Letters or words or punctuation marks.
160? That's not much for a proper poem, is it?
Well, why not? Some of the best poems can say a lot in very little space. And that is the whole art of text messaging, isn't it? And texting means you can be really brief. For example, instead of writing Y-O-U for the word you, we put just the letter U.
I'm not sure what my old English teacher would have to say about that. So, Tim, did many people enter?
About 7,500, actually. Most of them were from people like me, who'd never tried to write a text poem before. They composed their poems on the train, in traffic jams, on boats, on buses, anywhere, in fact. A short list of favourite entries was drawn up, and these poems were texted to each entrant. We all awarded each poem marks out of 10, so the final judges were the text poets themselves.
It sounds great fun. And the second competition is just being started, isn't it?
Yes, and there are really good cash prizes for winners. Plus, the chance to see your entry displayed on posters on 7,000 London buses and in the underground stations.
So, how do we enter?
Just text your poem to 880-1111. Oh, and you can find more information about the competition and can read last year's winning entries for inspiration on the internet at www.textpoetry.com. It's great fun, and you've got nothing to lose. Good luck.
That is the end of part two. In a moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3. Part 3, Exercise 1. Question 9. Listen to the following interview about ice cream, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Do you enjoy eating ice cream? Antonio Ponti from Italy is here today to tell us all about the history of one of the world's favourite treats. Hello, Antonio. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Tell us, how was ice cream invented?
Well, there are lots of theories. Being an Italian, I like to think it was invented in Italy. One theory is that the Grand Duke of Toledo was probably the first person to create and eat ice cream, something like the sort we eat now. He had an ice house built in the grounds of his Italian estate in 1576. This was meant to keep his drink cool with snow, you see. That was the only way in which they kept drinks cool in the 16th century in places like that.
I see. How does this link with ice cream as we know it today?
The Grand Duke invented a mixture of boiling grape juice, which he poured over iced milk from his ice house, and drank in the middle of the night to get rid of his indigestion.
Really?
Yes. It's written about in historical documents. He then tried mixing frozen milk and egg yolk, and there was the first ice cream.
Ice cream couldn't have been invented without snow, then. I always think of sun when I think of Italy. Strange it got invented there.
Well, Italy luckily has plenty of snow as well as sun. Ideal conditions for making and enjoying ice cream, of course. So the Italians experimented with different ingredients, such as lemon and orange peel, and the spices coriander and cinnamon.
I have to admit, I'd always thought ice cream was an English invention.
Oh, nonsense. But it's true that you British have liked it for almost as long as us. There's evidence that in England, ice cream was served to the king in the year 1671. Ice cream was a really fashionable food in 17th century England, you see, only fit for royalty and the very rich. Then, in 1856, an Englishman called William Fuller invented an ice cream-making tub and published a book of ice cream recipes. And in the 20th century, refrigerators made it possible for ordinary households in England to make and store ice cream for themselves.
So, that's some of its history. Can ice cream evolve any more, do you think?
Well, there's a trend for unexpected flavours, like, oh, cheese and onion ice cream, tomato and egg ice cream, or tuna fish ice cream.
Ooh.
I've even heard of an American burger ice cream.
Oh, yuck! That sounds really dreadful. I'll stick with my favourite vanilla and fruit flavours, I think.
Yes, you can't go wrong with those traditional flavours. Vanilla has been the world's favourite flavour since 1850. I also like chocolate, but my personal favourite has to be a delicious ice cream flavoured with a spice called sumac that I ate in both Kuwait and Egypt last year. The best I had ever tasted.
Oh, I'm going to Cairo next month, so I'll have to see if I can find some. Is ice cream good for us, do you think?
Yes, nutritionally, it's wonderful for the elderly and young children because of its vitamins and fat content, but in moderation, of course.
I really like blueberries. What should I do to make a blueberry ice cream?
Easy. Why not try with just blueberry jam and cream to start with? Just pour it all into a shallow dish, freeze it, turn it out and whip it up, and then refreeze. Delicious.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Do you enjoy eating ice cream? Antonio Ponti from Italy is here today to tell us all about the history of one of the world's favourite treats. Hello, Antonio. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Tell us, how was ice cream invented?
Well, there are lots of theories. Being an Italian, I like to think it was invented in Italy. One theory is that the Grand Duke of Toledo was probably the first person to create and eat ice cream, something like the sort we eat now. He had an ice house built in the grounds of his Italian estate in 1576. This was meant to keep his drink cool with snow, you see. That was the only way in which they kept drinks cool in the 16th century in places like that.
I see. How does this link with ice cream as we know it today?
The Grand Duke invented a mixture of boiling grape juice, which he poured over iced milk from his ice house, and drank in the middle of the night to get rid of his indigestion.
Really?
Yes. It's written about in historical documents. He then tried mixing frozen milk and egg yolk, and there was the first ice cream.
Ice cream couldn't have been invented without snow, then. I always think of sun when I think of Italy. Strange it got invented there.
Well, Italy luckily has plenty of snow as well as sun. Ideal conditions for making and enjoying ice cream, of course. So the Italians experimented with different ingredients, such as lemon and orange peel, and the spices coriander and cinnamon.
I have to admit, I'd always thought ice cream was an English invention.
Oh, nonsense. But it's true that you British have liked it for almost as long as us. There's evidence that in England, ice cream was served to the king in the year 1671. Ice cream was a really fashionable food in 17th century England, you see, only fit for royalty and the very rich. Then, in 1856, an Englishman called William Fuller invented an ice cream-making tub and published a book of ice cream recipes. And in the 20th century, refrigerators made it possible for ordinary households in England to make and store ice cream for themselves.
So, that's some of its history. Can ice cream evolve any more, do you think?
Well, there's a trend for unexpected flavours, like, oh, cheese and onion ice cream, tomato and egg ice cream, or tuna fish ice cream.
Ooh.
I've even heard of an American burger ice cream.
Oh, yuck. That sounds really dreadful. I'll stick with my favourite vanilla and fruit flavours, I think.
Yes, you can't go wrong with those traditional flavours. Vanilla has been the world's favourite flavour since 1850. I also like chocolate, but my personal favourite has to be a delicious ice cream flavoured with a spice called sumac that I ate in both Kuwait and Egypt last year. The best I had ever tasted.
Oh, I'm going to Cairo next month, so I'll have to see if I can find some. Is ice cream good for us, do you think?
Yes, nutritionally, it's wonderful for the elderly and young children because of its vitamins and fat content, but in moderation, of course.
I really like blueberries. What should I do to make a blueberry ice cream?
Easy. Why not try with just blueberry jam and cream to start with? Just pour it all into a shallow dish, freeze it, turn it out and whip it up, and then refreeze. Delicious.
That is the end of Part 3, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 3, Exercise 2. Question 10. Listen to the following talk about the development of the antibiotic medicine called penicillin, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the talk twice.
Nearly 77 years ago, on September the 3rd, 1928, the famous scientist Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin. This antibiotic revolutionized medicine in the second half of the 20th century, and we have probably all used it at some time to help heal us from an infection. Alexander Fleming was born into a family of sheep farmers in Scotland in 1881, but he didn't follow his family into sheep farming. At school, his teachers spotted his abilities in science subjects, and he later was sent to study medicine at a hospital in London. Subsequently, he became a bacteriologist, a scientist who specializes in the study of bacteria, the tiny organisms that live in earth, water, plants, and animals, and which can often cause disease. Fleming became famous because he discovered something that helped to preserve the health of the world. However, the whole process by which this happened was actually accidental. He was researching influenza, or flu, when he noticed that the bacteria he was using did not grow on areas where the penicillin bacteria had been. Fleming tried diluting the penicillin 800 times, but the effect was still the same. Still, nothing grew where the penicillin had been used. Also, the penicillin seemed to kill many of the other bacteria that infected humans and caused illnesses. Fleming made this discovery in 1928. However, it wasn't until the late 1930s that a group of scientists purified penicillin by carrying out tests to make sure that it was not toxic, poisonous, for human use. Its first public use was in 1941. By then, chemists had developed an injectable form of penicillin. In those times, small amounts of the antibiotic penicillin were grown in jars. Nowadays, huge containers of it are grown, as it is so widely used by doctors and hospitals. The discovery of this antibiotic was not all good news, though. Often, patients are allergic to penicillin and suffer from skin rashes, swelling, or shock. Also, some bacteria are now resistant to penicillin, as it has been used too profusely. In 2002, for example, more than 36 million courses of antibiotics were prescribed in Britain alone. Since 1928, hundreds of different antibiotic medicines have been discovered and developed. Penicillin, though, still remains very important as an antibiotic therapy. This is all thanks to Alexander Fleming, the accidental hero of medicine.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Nearly 77 years ago, on September the 3rd, 1928, the famous scientist Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin. This antibiotic revolutionized medicine in the second half of the 20th century, and we have probably all used it at some time to help heal us from an infection. Alexander Fleming was born into a family of sheep farmers in Scotland in 1881. But he didn't follow his family into sheep farming. At school, his teachers spotted his abilities in science subjects, and he later was sent to study medicine at a hospital in London. Subsequently, he became a bacteriologist, a scientist who specializes in the study of bacteria, the tiny organisms that live in earth, water, plants, and animals, and which can often cause disease. Fleming became famous because he discovered something that helped to preserve the health of the world. However, the whole process by which this happened was actually accidental. He was researching influenza, or flu, when he noticed that the bacteria he was using did not grow on areas where the penicillin bacteria had been. Fleming tried diluting the penicillin 800 times, but the effect was still the same. Still, nothing grew where the penicillin had been used. Also, the penicillin seemed to kill many of the other bacteria that infected humans and caused illnesses. Fleming made this discovery in 1928. However, it wasn't until the late 1930s that a group of scientists purified penicillin by carrying out tests to make sure that it was not toxic, poisonous, for human use. Its first public use was in 1941. By then, chemists had developed an injectable form of penicillin. In those times, small amounts of the antibiotic penicillin were grown in jars. Nowadays, huge containers of it are grown, as it is so widely used by doctors and hospitals. The discovery of this antibiotic was not all good news, though. Often, patients are allergic to penicillin and suffer from skin rashes, swelling, or shock. Also, some bacteria are now resistant to penicillin, as it has been used too profusely. In 2002, for example, more than 36 million courses of antibiotics were prescribed in Britain alone. Since 1928, hundreds of different antibiotic medicines have been discovered and developed. Penicillin, though, still remains very important as an antibiotic therapy. This is all thanks to Alexander Fleming, the accidental hero of medicine.
That is the end of part three and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your centre number, candidate number, and your name on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.